The Guardian. Moira de Schwart works for the St John Ambulance Service as an administrator.
I'm vastly obese, what they call morbidly obese, and I'm really battling now with mobility issues. I don't actually know what my weight is because I'm over the 150 k's that the gym scale picks up. So I have no real idea of how much I weigh exactly.
Moira has lived in Johannesburg, South Africa, all her life.
I'm on the Tim Noakes diet. This is a low carbohydrate and then high fat.
Most people think obesity is a problem for countries like the USA and the UK, but the diet and lifestyles that caused the obesity epidemics in affluent nations are being exported all over the world. Middle-income countries like South Africa and Mexico now have a massive problem, and it's only a matter of time before the poorest are in the same plight. Sandeep Ruda is an endocrinologist at the Charlotte Maxiki Johannesburg Academic Hospital.
South Africa is a melting pot of various cultures and even economic dynamics. So the reasons would be the traditional reasons that you see in the first world, first of all. And that would relate to urbanization, change in diet, high caloric content foods, sedentary lifestyles. And you're seeing that with urbanization, so people moving into cities, more office jobs, access to high calorie foods, and becoming sedentary, really. There's also a bit of a perception issue. So within the South African black culture, being overweight or just being larger in size is associated with a perception of health, being rich and well off.
I think South Africans eat a lot of meat generally. And I don't know that I eat more meat than other South Africans. So I think the biggest culprits are the sugars and the carbs.
When you look at the figures, 56% of females are overweight or obese. And in that category, the predominant, it's the black females that have the highest prevalence of being overweight and obese. Whereas in the male category, it's the other way around. So white males are the most overweight and obese of the 25-odd% that are overweight obese, and black males fall last into that category, whereas mixed race and others in between. So I think it's quite a mixed dynamic. I think with the middle class in South Africa, they are more aware of body weight. They do perceive overweight and obesity at an earlier stage, and studies have shown this, whereas in black patients, that perception is not there. It's underestimated.
Statistically, I think we were about number 4 in the world. So yes, obesity is a problem in South Africa. It's part of the fact that South Africans don't tend to exercise in the normal course and scope of their daily life. We hop into our cars and we drive to places that in other parts of the country we would walk to. In our particular lifestyle, I think food is ubiquitous, and we are very proud as South Africans of our hospitality, which comes with some of the lovely traditional cakes and foods that we make in South Africa.
We have well over 800 million people who are hungry, who are chronically hungry. We have well over 2 billion people who suffer from one or at least one micronutrient deficiency.
This is Jomo Kwame Sundaram. He is Assistant Director General for Economic and Social Development at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN.
In the past, there was simplistic assumption that overweightness and obesity had to do with what was rather callously referred to as overnutrition or overnourishment. And it was presumed that it had to do with wealth. Now we understand that, in fact, in the richer countries of the world, the ones who are more likely to be overweight and obese are likely to be those from the lower income groups. And in fact, it is in the middle income countries where the problems of obesity and related non-communicable diseases are growing fastest.
Tim Lobstein is the Director of Policy and Head of Research Programmes at the World Obesity Federation in London.
I think unless there's a critical famine going on, then yes, you'll find these patterns now in Bangladesh, you'll find them in Zimbabwe and Zambia and so on. You'll find these problems of undernourishment in some impoverished areas and then excessive fats and sugars intake, particularly in urban areas and amongst those that can afford access to these processed foods. So it's a transition from inadequate supplies or perhaps adequate but not commercialized to rapidly commercialized supplies. And the commercial products coming in for low-income countries tend to be these soft drinks, fortified noodles, various products that may have some nutrients in them, but they don't have the full range of fruits, vegetables, lean meats and so on that we're all recommended to eat.
You could argue that this might be the price of development, that as people become more affluent, their diets change. That's certainly the case in America and the European Union. And following in their footsteps are middle-income countries like South Africa and Mexico.
America is no longer number one on the obesity charts. According to a study released last month by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, Mexico just inches past, pun intended, the United States as the fattest nation in the...
I went to Mexico a year ago to find out how it had come to have the highest levels of childhood obesity in the world and the remarkable campaign that was fought to do something about it. In today's programme, we hear from some of the people I spoke to for my book, The Shape We're In. We'll hear from those affected by obesity, the clinicians trying to help them, and the campaigners trying to turn back the tide of processed food and drink in Mexican society. I'm Sarah Bosley. That's all to come on this Global Development podcast from The Guardian. Norma Castillo first took her daughter to a hospital when she was 8. It was to look at marks on her skin, so she went to a dermatological ward. But they were quickly referred to a clinic that specialises in obese children. At the time, the 8-year-old Maite was 20 kilos overweight.
Yo me acuerdo que desde que ella estaba chiquita, ella siempre fue así robusta.
I remember that she was always robust when she was little. Well, she was a little, let's not say fat. She was filled out. I didn't see any problem with it. But when we came here and they told me that she was 20 kilos overweight, the truth is that I got worried. I never thought it was that much.
This is her daughter, the now 16-year-old Maite.
I feel like food is a refuge where I can forget my problems. I like sweets a lot. They lift my spirits.
The obesity clinic Maite found herself in was run by Dr. Salvador Villalpando.
We started out probably in 1999 when we feared that there was 24% of kids between 5 and 11 years of age overweight or obesity. And then it started trending higher when in the second national survey in 2006, we were around 32%, and now we're around 34%, which is very, very worrying because we thought there would be like small changes that should be done, but they didn't work, and now it's getting a lot more complicated. Safety in the streets, you know, that kids won't go outside to play because there's not enough security. Food size portions, you know, we have very Americanized food size portions.
Eva Lilia Delgado lives with her son in Ecatepec, on the outskirts of Mexico City, a place that is currently badly affected by violence.
Si no se puede ir o dejarlos libres a que vayan al parque, a que jueguen.
You can't let them go and play or go to the park because there is lots of violence and insecurity and they steal children. And I don't have the money to buy a stationary bike, which is what I would like to do so that he gets some exercise.
What we do here at the Hospital Infantil is that we try to design interventions that work for our community. You can find in medical literature that there are many designs for trials, you know, trials to make kids lose weight, but they don't have that big an impact. So what we say here is that when we get to obesity, we're too late. You know, when we have to treat obesity, we're too late.
The results of treatment have not been encouraging.
We're doing as well as in probably any other clinic that has to deal with kids with obesity. So we can take like 18% of the obese kids down to overweight. The big problem is that when they go, they stay at home and they're not coming back to the clinic, we see them after 6 months, and we only keep like 6% of the total amount of kids without obesity of that same group. That means we have like 94% of failure, 94% of failure by after 1 year of treatment. It's a lot of failure.
Tim Lobstein.
We haven't seen very successful treatment for children. We've seen some successful treatment for seriously obese adults through surgery. There are some drug trials that are proving fairly successful, but this isn't really the way to go for preventing obesity. It is a way to go if all you're going to do is treat it, but that's an expensive solution, particularly if you go down the surgical route. That's hugely expensive and not really the way we would like to see the world develop. You don't want to see people get obese, get seriously ill, and then have surgery. That isn't the ideal situation. But there are treatment plans available to help children. They're not necessarily very successful because children, once you've got their weight down, are then, if you like, thrown back into a highly obesogenic environment where, you know, they're being encouraged to overconsume again. The ads are on television, the soft drinks and fatty foods and sugary cereals are all very cheap and highly promoted, and they want them. So you end up putting children back into a situation where they're going to put weight on again.
Yeah, it's very discouraging. But still, you see there's a huge problem and somebody's got to do something about it. Kids will still be coming in the clinic and you'll have to show some interest in their achievements. So you have to set your mind on that.
David is 13. He's about 1.50 meters tall and weighs 57 kilos. He should probably weigh around 44 kilos.
No, pues todo el mundo está exagerando.
I think everyone's exaggerating. I think it's normal.
Yo digo que todo está bien.
I think it's fine, really.
Pues no tiene nada de
There's
malo,
nothing wrong with being bonito. A little fat.
So can Mexico kick its addiction? Dr. Villalpando.
How do we do it? It's a secret. No, it's not no secret. It's like we lower the recommended for their age. Sometimes just stopping soda, quitting out soda, makes a huge difference. I can tell you about 2 kilos loss in 1 month just because of stopping soda.
Can sugary drinks really be the cause of Mexico's troubles? Alejandro Calvillo is a leading consumer activist from the campaign group El Poder del Consumidor.
We have the highest consumption of soda in all the world. We have an average of 163 liters per person of soda a year. No, this is 30% above the United States consumption, that is the second country in soda consumption.
Johan is 10 years old. He was first taken to the hospital with a pain in his gallbladder. His grandmother, Cristina Gutierrez, looks after him.
Before, we drank 2 bottles of soda a day in the house. Bottles of 3 liters.
There are lots of reasons why Mexico has such a love of soda. In rural areas, where there wasn't clean drinking water, Coke's phenomenal distribution system ensured there was always a bottle of Coke on the table. And even in the cities, where there is clean water, people rely on soda. Dr. Villalpando.
There was some sort of issue back in 1985 in the big city, in Mexico City, right after the earthquake, when water pipes were broken and polluted, and they started consuming bottled water. We just lost the tradition of drinking water of the faucet, and I think it has to do with that. And in some instances, there's more availability of soda all over. Back in 2009, there was a law that forbid the sodas inside schools, which I know that works inside the schools, but outside of school, there's no limitation on that.
Alejandro Calvillo again.
Coke promotion is everywhere. hospitals, schools. Now we have now a regulation in schools, and we are trying to implement this regulation. And also a problem is that the government not do anything in campaigns and not give a guarantee of potable water, not for schools, not for houses. We have a problem of access to potable water, but also we don't have any kind of program to promote filters in houses. And many people, at the same time that we are the highest consumer of soda, we are the highest consumer of bottled water.
Added to this was a government seduced by big business and afraid of losing industrial growth.
It was a sort of a standing joke in many nutrition communities in discussing Mexico that you could not expect otherwise if a former president of a leading popular beverage company became the president of the country. One should not be too surprised to find that there are these kinds of changes.
Jomo is talking about Vicente Fox. He was the former head of Coca-Cola in Mexico and became the country's president in 2000. He was there for 6 years.
The previous governments that had like a very particular trend of protecting work sources and big industries like that, like Coca-Cola. I don't know if Coca-Cola really, but there has been some sort of protection for this kind of industries, that you could see that happening in the junk food and soda legislation for schools, that there was a lot of scientists and medical societies were against having any sort of food inside the schools, and the last call was made by the economy ministry, which was very interested in not losing a large population, a large market of foods that were, I don't know the figure, but it was around something around $4 billion a year in all the schools. So they weren't willing to lose that market. So the whole act softened because of the economy ministry.
If you look the health minister in Mexico, they are not fighting, no. They are very close to the industry. The soda tax came from the Minister of Finance, no, and the other regulations. This regulation inside the schools came from a long battle from the National Institute of Public Health and the National Institute of Nutrition. And the regulation marketing also came from the battle of many years. It's something that I think that also I never listened the health minister talking about, that we need to have a more strong regulation of marketing or a better labeling. No, they support the labeling developed by the industries.
Más de 70 millones de mexicanos tienen sobre.
This advert campaigning for a soda tax has been the result of years of campaigning. The three main broadcasters in Mexico refused to show it, but cable channels and the internet got the message across.
Apoya el impuesto a refrescos y bebidas azucaradas por un México más sano.
The soda tax began the 1st January of 2014, no, and the tax is around 10% of the price, and is in sodas with or any drink that have sugars added.
What might be surprising is the way in which the campaign came about. Tim Lobstein again.
We've seen a fascinating example in Mexico, where the government was fairly reluctant to take any initiatives. It was under the thrall of food companies largely. And then in came a $10 million donation from Bloomberg Philanthropies to local non-governmental organizations, to campaigns and advocacy groups, who campaigned vigorously on having a soft drinks tax, on having limitations on advertising of junk food on television. And thanks to that impetus, they've seen those changes. Whether we'll get a change in child obesity, I don't know, but the soft drinks tax has certainly reduced the consumption of soft drinks in that country, and we're hoping the junk food advertising bans will also have an impact there. So that's an interesting example, because that isn't your usual use of philanthropic money. Normally you will see it go to places like rural schools for health education development or something for young mothers or something like this. Here it went directly to campaigning organisations campaigning on government policy issues, and I think that's a fascinating change and an interesting development in world policies.
But Calvillo doesn't think the tax in Mexico goes far enough.
We ask for a 20% tax that all the international literature and the recommendation was to have an important reduction in soda consumption, you need to improve a tax of 20%. The government, we asked to put this money that came from the tax for health promotion and also to introduce drinking fountains inside of all the schools. But the finance minister and the government, federal government, they denied to give a destiny to the resources for special taxes, because they say that if this happened one time, this will happen all the time. And they say that they are putting more money for health issues and for prevention than the money that they are having now through the tax.
It's not just about Big Soda. 10 companies control most of the packaged food that is exported around the world. And processed food, or as one expert I spoke to calls it, ultra-processed food, is causing a lot of the harm. And that's not just in Mexico. It's everywhere. People have stopped cooking traditional meals from fresh produce, or even if they do, they supplement it with snacks. So calories have gone up massively. And there's precious little that can be done for those who are already obese. Cristina Gutierrez is listening to Dr. Villalpando's advice, hoping her grandson, Johan, can be one of the 6% able to keep the weight off.
We don't drink soda anymore. We have changed the kind of soups, the carbohydrates, we have changed the biscuits. We used to buy 2 boxes of biscuits a day. We eat less dairy too.
In the face of such odds, all the real change has to come from government. And regulation of the food and drinks industries is getting the attention of health ministers in other middle-income countries.
There are foundations and there are movements to support these sorts of approaches. I think we may see something developing in India. We may see some actions in southern Africa, particularly South Africa, where there are moves to strengthen government policies on restricting advertising to children. And across the world, there are now increasing concerns about not only breast milk formula feeding, but also complementary foods that are being sold in place of traditional weaning foods. And those, there is the fear that these commercialized complementary foods transfer children not from a milk-based diet to family foods, but from a milk-based diet to a taste for highly processed foods. So that's another area that both the World Health Organization and our organization are concerned about.
Is very much happening in South Africa at the moment?
South Africa, as far as I can recall now, they have got some legislation in process to restrict advertising to children and to improve the labeling of foods. I don't know what sort of political opposition that is meeting, because often enough a government health department will want to promote these sorts of actions, but the ministries of economics or treasury or trade start to resist them because they see there are some economic downsides to these sorts of controls on the market.
It is sometimes difficult to pass legislation, isn't it? Soda tax legislation or any other sort, because you run up against the economic arguments, particularly in developing countries.
Well, you certainly run up against the interested industries, and they put forward economic arguments saying that they will pull out and there'll be large unemployment or whatever. But actually, if you start doing the sums about the costs in terms of lost productivity due to diabetes and obesity, or the costs to the health services, if it's a socialized health service in any way, then there's a social cost to high levels of ill health. Then you start setting that against the lost economic benefits. Then perhaps you see a different picture, and it's well worth doing those sums, because generally you come out thinking that actually doing nothing is not an option. The health crisis will cost far too much.
In some ways, it would be a successful solution for everybody if people went back to a traditional diet and the farmers locally could buy the food they need, which has the right sort of nutrients.
Yes, I think this has been done not only in China. To some extent, you see some encouragement of local farmers for school feeding programs. But these are all considered to be subsidies. And there has been in recent decades a big push against the elimination of subsidies. So it's only countries like Brazil and China who are big enough, who have the means to do so, who have defied international pressures to eliminate such subsidies. But elsewhere in the world, you have very little support for such schemes. So as a consequence, this exacerbates the problem. But to be quite realistic, with the high levels of urbanization in the world, with a big push for farmers to produce cash crops rather than food crops, it is very difficult to see this as the solution. And in other words, we really need a solution which recognizes that many of these changes which have taken place in the world are almost irreversible.
Well, that's a really terrible thing to say, isn't it? If these changes are irreversible, then we will progress to become a much more obese planet entirely, will we not?
Well, I just to give you one instance of success, I think in mid last year, there was a report which suggested that in the previous decade, childhood obesity in the US had gone down by 43%. Now, that is a very impressive reduction, but it began, of course, with very high levels of childhood obesity. So it is reversible, and I think we should be looking towards these kinds of gains rather than in trying to reverse urbanization, which is unlikely to take place, or to try to force farmers to produce food crops which might actually result in much lower incomes for them. So we need to begin to find other ways. We have health warnings on smoking. There's absolutely no reason why we cannot have health warnings on certain types of foods, if not to prohibit such foods.
We need to have a more strong regulation on marketing and meat to children, not only some hours, some programs on TV. We need to cover all TV, and we need to cover internet. We need to cover point of sale of these products, not in the supermarkets, the designs of the ball box of the cereals and all of these things. We need to improve this regulation.
The World Health Organization has moved its agenda significantly from the focus on undernutrition to a dual focus now on ensuring adequate nutrition, but also preventing the development of non-communicable diseases, particularly heart disease, cancers, diabetes and so on, that are largely a result of this excess consumption of processed foods.
And I think we're sitting on a ticking time bomb here, because it's very silent epidemics, and you see the consequences much later. We're now starting to see the consequences of childhood obesity later in life. So if you've got a large proportion of your population that are overweight at a young age, you're going to see the consequences of that 20, 30 years down the line.
I think obesity is here to stay as a huge issue, because it's the cause of so many other health problems, be it heart disease or diabetes or some cancers and orthopedic problems and so on. You get a whole range of issues that are a result of obesity and which cause people to feel unwell, to get backache, to not do their jobs so well, to lose their income. And these are problems for individuals, problems for families and lost income. And particularly in developing economies, you just can't afford to have an ill labor force. And if people are moving from undernourishment to excess obesity, you're not helping that country to grow its economy and be a healthy, thriving country.
Losing weight long term is incredibly hard, as anyone who has ever tried to diet will know. What we need to do is prevent people becoming obese and suffering serious health problems in the first place. There is a lot to do, but top of the agenda, we have to tackle the availability of junk food and drink in every country. Thank you for listening to the Guardian Global Development Podcast and to all our speakers. The interviews you've heard today were by David Smith in Johannesburg and Joe Tuckman in Mexico City. Thanks to them. You can hear more episodes of issues facing the developing world from the environment to women's rights by subscribing to our podcast feed. Just head to theguardian.com/global-development. My name is Sarah Bosley. The producer was Matt Hill. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.